Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome, listeners. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. He's going to get a little tired of that handle sooner or later, but we'll carry on. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Kieran Doherty. Without him, we just wouldn't sound as good as we'd like to think we do. And supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Carolyn Nikolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful efforts. So, Bernie, how about a quick recap from the previous podcast on real estate regulations with our guest, Daryl Bandoro? He was quite interesting, wasn't he?
He was. One of the strongest takeaways that I had was doing the due diligence. And how do you do that? So what's your history of bringing your project together? And, you know, tell me who you worked with. And the longer they've worked with you and the good reviews, the stronger you can feel confident that you're going to be going down the right path. And it has to be a right fit, too. And if it's not a fit, then, you know, you shouldn't be doing it or you're taking a risk.
Yeah, one of the things Daryl kept on emphasizing was due diligence, due diligence, due diligence. And that's so important. Know who you're investing with. Know your project. And as those listeners who listen to the podcast realized, I'm very big on actually being able to touch the investment. I'm very big on actually being able to take a look at the building and pointing and saying, I own that building, or we as a group own that building. I'm not a big advocate of investments that are outside your immediate sphere. Now, there are exceptions to that, of course, but when we're talking bricks and mortar, real estate, I like something tangible, something that you can actually touch. So anyways, that was a great podcast. We were very fortunate to have Daryl and someone with his experience on the program. You've got mail. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
Ready? Yes, there is. We have Steve from Toronto. He just finished season one of The Property Wizard, and he enjoyed it, which is great. In episode 3, he makes mention that you talk about different types of real estate investments. Could you expand on your comment about home ownership being considered a great place to start?
Boy, episode 3, that's going back a little bit, but I'm a very strong advocate of people that are interested in investing in real estate, investing first in their own home. When I'm asked the question, should I buy a home or should I buy an income property? I say, well, you can do both. Buy a home and maybe put an in-law suite in the basement. Maybe rent a room. If the lot allows it, build a secondary living unit on your lot. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we talk about the in the news item that I've chosen for today. But yes, it's not for me an either or proposition. It's you can do both. So yes, single family homes, particularly your first one, an excellent first choice as far as a real estate investment is concerned. I hope that elaborates just enough for you. Thanks for the question, Steve.
Now we have another question from Janet, and she's in Aurelia. Her boyfriend and her keep going back and forth whether to include real estate as part of their investment strategy. He's more into the GICs and mutual funds. She would like to include real estate in her long-term strategy, or in their long-term strategy, in fact. What help can we offer them?
Okay, great question. Thank you very much, Janet. I hope this hasn't become too much of a contentious issue for you. When it comes to investing in real estate, again, I am a very strong proponent of having real estate in your investment portfolio. And it goes back actually to our very first podcast when I spoke about how unique purchasing real estate is in the investment world. There isn't another investment like it where other people actually pay and create equity for you. Let me just put in a different slant or a different picture. I was speaking to a novice investor earlier this week, and they asked me very much the same question. And the way I answered it was, you don't have to own 6 units, 100 units, 1,000 units to take advantage of the unique properties that real estate possess. If you purchased a townhouse, just a townhouse, I'm not talking about multiple townhouses. I'm not talking about a sixplex. I'm talking about a single townhouse. Let's say you bought it and you're 30, 40, 50 years old. You could reasonably expect that in 20 years' time, that townhouse will probably more than likely be paid for. And the best thing about that is that you're not using your money to pay for it. The tenant who rents that townhouse from you is actually creating your equity and paying that property in full. So again, I know it's maybe a long-term plan, but let's say 20 years has gone by and now it's time to retire. That townhouse, let's forget about appreciation. Let's say you bought the townhouse at $400,000, but now 20 years later, it's paid for. Now, we all know realistically, it's probably worth a lot more than the $400,000 you paid for it. But at the end of the day, that $400,000 is going to make a huge difference to you when it comes time to retire. It's as simple as that. And that's a single townhouse. And that's why I'm such a strong advocate for an investment in real estate. It can make such a huge difference with a little bit of foresight. So my answer to you is yes, by all means. I want to try to alleviate your boyfriend's concerns. Maybe he thinks that you're planning on becoming a real estate mega landlord. And that's fantastic, a great plan for some, but it's not for everybody. So I think there's a compromise there, Janet. And I would suggest that you dip your toes into the market, buy maybe a property and see how it goes. You'll never, ever be sorry for doing that. And in very, very short order, sounds to me like I'm a little older than you are, but in very short order, it'll come time to retire. And you are going to be so happy you bought that property. And it'll make a great difference to both you and your boyfriend. Thank you for the question, Janet.
Got one last question here in the mailbag. And is from Rebecca from Atlanta. She's currently taking a real estate course through her estate licensing program. And she's finding it hard to understand what capitalization rates have to do with assessing the value of a property. For her, it seems like it's backwards.
Great question. And I'm asked this question a lot by not just pre-licensed students, but even seasoned real estate professionals who maybe aren't familiar with the commercial or investment real estate world. It's a little difficult to explain during the course of a podcast, but I think where the confusion arises is that capitalization rates, you would feel, not understanding the formulation, that the higher the cap rate, the higher the value of the property. That's completely inverse to what reality is. The lower the cap rate, the higher the value of the property. And that's where a lot of confusion lies in. Now, if you can visualize, I refer to it as the IRV formula. And it's very, very simple. IRV, like I-R-V. So what you do is you draw a pyramid with the I representing income at the top of that pyramid. And below that, you have on the left, R, which is referring to the capitalization rate, or in this case, just rate. And on the right, you have V, which represents value. So in order to establish value, what you do is you take the capitalization rate and divide it into the net operating income, not the gross, the net operating income. And that will establish value. So when I'm explaining this to students, what I do is I have them do exactly what I've asked you to do. Draw a pyramid, put an I, a R, and a V. And if you want to discover what the value is of a property, just take your finger and cover up the V. And what you're left with is I over R, or income divided by rate. So it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to realize that the lower the rate, the more that multiple will actually go into income. Hence, the value will be greater. So at the end of the day, it's a very, very important formalization to understand and grasp. If you need any more information, if you send me an email, I'll be happy to send you a short video that we have that explains it very in crystal clear terms. Again, thank you for the question. I hope I've been able to answer it. And in the meantime, if you need a further or more in-depth explanation, just again, send me a quick email. It's easy for me to send off the video that we prepared. Thank you very much for the question, Rebecca.
That's great, Freddie. So if you have any questions, folks, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. RYRES.com. And Freddie, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Boy, have I got some great news for you if you live in the province of Ontario. The Ford government introduced the More Homes Built Faster Act, or MHBFA, this week. And it is an exciting opportunity for smaller investors and those of us who invest in smaller property with the eye increasing density, with an eye towards putting in in-law suites or building auxiliary units on the land. Essentially, what this act allows and is mandated by the province of Ontario is that it's meant to enable and expedite additional residential units in existing residential areas. As a right, zoning for higher density around transit area is strongly recommended, and it limits the influence of NIMBY, not in my backyard, groups by preventing third-party appeals for all planning matters. Now, that has to be music to everyone's ears, because usually the strongest proponent against any type of intensification or the expansion of the urban boundary comes from NIMBY groups. And it is a very tough political situation for a number of city councils to deal with. It's a situation where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Yes, there's pressure to increase intensification, but at the same time, the neighbors don't want it. So the province has kind of removed that responsibility from councils and has introduced a number of different policies that are going to be enacted apparently by June of 2023, which is going to take that away from city councils. And it's going to take it away from these special interest groups that just freeze any type of potential expansion. So amongst the things or items that are being allowed, in a nutshell, under this legislation, up to 3 units will be allowed on a single residential lot without any bylaw amendments or municipal permissions. Now, let me read that again. Up to 3 units will be allowed on a single residential lot without any bylaw amendments or municipal permissions. How many horror stories have we heard about people wanting to put an in-law suite not being allowed to? I mean, essentially what this does, it takes every R1 zone in the province and allows you to put a triplex on it. It's an amazing opportunity for smaller investors and smaller builders. This is going to be, and I think, go a long way to solving the issue or the province to build an additional 1.5 million housing units. Further, these units would be exempt from development charges and parkland dedication fees, which we all know adds considerably to the cost of any type of renovation or new build. The province will also scrap fees, including development charges, parkland dedication levies, and community benefit charges for affordable housing, nonprofit housing, and inclusionary zoning units. This is in addition to reducing development charges by up to 25% for family size rental units. In addition to that, conservation authority fees for development permits will be temporarily frozen. Government officials have also said that authorities will no longer need to consider factors such as pollution or land conservation when approving permit requirements. Instead, development regulations will be streamlined to focus on natural hazards such as flooding and erosion. Now, keep in mind that most of these units that they're allowing to be built are going to be in already established neighborhoods. So there's not going to be a great deal of an additional structure or infrastructure that needs to be built to accommodate this. I think it's a win-win situation. This article, which I was remiss in not crediting to Catherine DeClercq from CTV News Toronto, also goes on to say, the province says it will also limit third-party appeals at the Ontario Land Tribunal for official plan amendments, zoning bylaw amendments, as well as minor variances and consents. And that also includes appeals made by individuals or community groups not directly involved in the development case. At the end of the day, listeners, this is an incredible opportunity for smaller landlords and developers to take a single family residence and make it into a viable income property. These rules and regulations are welcomed, and I think it's about time. The only person that's going to create a headache for are those people who are adamant when it comes to any type of NIMBYism, and it's going to create a little bit of stress for certain municipal town councils too. Nobody likes being dictated to, but I think the province has taken a lot of the issues away from the cities involved. And that should, at the end of the day, make it easier for them after they've adjusted to cope. So a great opportunity. I think we should all take advantage of it and look forward to the legislation passing. Thank you. Listeners, I have a fantastic guest for you today. Please welcome Eric Sonego. Eric is an accountant, and he's going to talk to us about what many people consider a real dry subject, and a lot of people don't give the attention to that they need. So, Eric, I'm going to get you to introduce yourself.
My name is Eric Sonego, as you've heard, and I'm an accountant in private practice since 1990. The roster of clients I have varies from medium-sized companies to mom-and-pop shops and self-employed individuals. And I do have, you know, clients who from time to time invest in real estate. And, you know, I hear all of the successes and tribulations of that usually in the month of March and April in my office. You know, the people who are not that comfortable with real estate are always worried. And the people who are comfortable with real estate are asking me to look at their next property. That's how it varies, you know. And the people who are worried is because they didn't plan any real estate acquisition. It fell on their lap, either because of a relative or because of an opportunity. The people who plan for it, the people who say, we're going to get to this point and then we're going to buy this, are the people who are much more likely to be developers of real estate, you know, even if it's only one unit. They have plans for the one unit, where the other people have plans for getting out of the one unit, you know, bringing up the equity to a certain point and selling it. It's a capital gains issue and it's not a lifelong issue.
Absolutely, Eric. You've described a number of our listeners out there. Some of our listeners just fall into a situation where they own, you know, not just their home, but maybe multiple pieces of real estate. And there's a great deal of that happening today. I field a number of questions just about that. That's why having you as a guest on this show today is so opportunistic. We're so happy to have you, Eric. We really are.
Thank you for having me. The problem starts, I think, at the high school level, in that we're not teaching our children numbers and how to read numbers in your own life. You know, we're teaching them to be employees and not managers of money, their own money. And when you teach someone to be an employee, you're teaching them to be the recipient of someone else's money for work. When you teach someone to be, you know, an owner of money, you teach them how to, you know, whatever that employer gives them, what to do with it, because that's their money. That's their pot. The other thing we don't teach people is, you know, what do we do in a capitalistic system? Because we live in a capitalistic system. So how do we get, you know, from point A to point B in a capitalistic system, which rewards certain tendencies and doesn't reward other tendencies?
Great insight. Really good insight, Eric. Yeah, I haven't heard it quite put in those terms, but that's tremendous insight. And it's so true. So very true. And that's on the heels of the latest study, which indicated in this province anyway, in the province of Ontario, that I believe was it grade 3 and grade 8 or 9 students are way behind the provincial standard when it comes to math, just basic math skills, which is... Now, mind you, this is just post-pandemic, but still, I mean, that really gets you wondering, particularly when you put it in the terms, Eric, that you just have. We don't teach students, yes, you know, the day-to-day realities about managing their own money and understanding it. So that's tremendous. Thank you for that input. So, Eric, what would you recommend is the absolute bare minimum in terms of bookkeeping any property owner should undertake?
In terms of bookkeeping, let's talk about the typical townhouse landlord. So the typical townhouse landlord that is renting to a third party, you know, that is not related to him, needs to have, number one, a lawyer that understands real estate before he starts with any bookkeeping. Number two, he needs to be able to separate that activity from the rest of his life. You know, so that activity has to stand on by itself. I even recommend that they have a separate bank account for that activity. They need to at least start with, you know, the rudimentary Excel worksheet. You know, this is the rent I collected. This is what my expenses are. And they need to realize that the only expense they can write off from that property, from a direct cost of that property, is the interest rate that the bank is charging them and not the mortgage payment that they're paying. So yes, we get into an idea of cash flow here. You know, you need to have the cash flow because there are hidden expenses that you do not see in the profit and loss statement, because they are expenses that affect the worth of the property and not the activity on the property. So one of the things they have to separate is that interest from principal, which is going to go on a place called the balance sheet, which every month will increase your equity in the property as you pay it. And the interest is the cost of the money you're renting from the bank to own that property. Then, you know, you have all of the other expenses that are directed to that property. One of the reasons people like rental income is because there's not that many things to take care of. You know, it's only direct cost. You may have advertising to advertise for a tenant. You have interest for the mortgage. You may have interest for other incidental lines of credit that you have related to the property. You have property taxes if you have to pay for them. Usually, all other expenses like heat, hydro, water, and so on can be attached to the tenant. But if they're not attached to the tenant, you also have it as an expense. Because people rent properties with the idea of rent net, you know, or net gross. So depending on how you structure your lease, you may have to pay for some of those utilities or not pay for those utilities. But the management of those expenses, you can find at Grand & Toy or you can find at Staples. And it's called an accordion box divided into months. If you put it there, if you put what's happening on a monthly basis, you can walk into my office and the most junior person can put it together to make a profit and loss statement and a tax return. Great. If you bring it in a box, you know, with everything that happened, you know, the benefit is that we're going to get to know you very, very well because we're going to get to know all of your life. The disadvantage is going to be that it's going to be pretty costly for someone to go through your life. Right. And the other thing that I should mention is behind you, there is a partner that you don't see. And that partner is called the Canada Revenue Agency. And the Canada Revenue Agency wants to see clean records that attach only to the property. What happens when they don't attach? They call that commingling. And that's a concept in tax where if I come to audit you and I see commingling, I audit all of you, not just your property. I audit you, anybody you pay through your bank, your in-laws, your cousins, your wife, your husband, everybody can be audited because of
no commingling, listeners. No.
So get out of commingling and make the property stand by itself with its own records. That is the most important thing you can do in any type of business venture.
Fantastic. Eric? And remember, accordion files. There's going to be a run on accordion files across North America after this podcast. Great point. Great record keeping point.
So, Eric, when you're running a business, you should register the business. Do you also incorporate it? Like, when do you incorporate? Should you incorporate as a landlord?
You incorporate when you have more than one property and you're in my office and you can't remember what is what. So you may be very confused with the activity in the property, and it may be very difficult for you to manage through a personal tax return. Because a personal tax return is most of the time simple businesses as opposed to businesses with a lot of other people in them. The other time you will incorporate is when you think that your business can have ramifications on your other facets of life. So you want to separate that business and make it a legal entity that it behaves by itself.
Yes. One thing, listeners, you have to keep in mind is that from a legal standpoint, an incorporation stands on its own. It's like giving birth to a child. You know, you still have to administer and it has to file its own income tax forms and pay taxes on its own, but it's a separate legal entity. So keep that in mind. And the point that our guest is making is very, very valid. You know, if you have more than one property, you usually want to separate them. And the easiest way to do that is by incorporating that particular entity, which and whose only job it is to hold a particular piece of real estate. There's a lot of nuances there, but at the end of the day, if you're going to be a multiple property owner, it's highly unlikely that your accountant, as just like Eric has stated, is going to suggest to you that you throw it all under one incorporation. It doesn't necessarily work well that way, but every circumstance is unique. So again, you need to pick up the phone and speak to somebody like Eric, and he is going to give you the right advice.
The other thing we have to remember is that the way that the tax system is structured is so that we have active income and passive income. And real estate falls under passive income because it's not you making money, it's your money making money. Now, when you're making money, in other words, when you're making widgets, when you're making a product, selling a service, the tax rates tend to be, for a corporation, they tend to be around 12.5%. But when your money's making money, which we call that investment, whether it's in real estate, whether it's in mutual funds, the tax rate goes up, you know, for corporations to around 38%. So there is a difference, you know, and people sometimes incorporate to have more than one property, because when you have multiple properties, you can say that that income is inventory income because you're in the business of buying and selling properties. And that income is, as opposed to being passive income, is active income. When it's active income, you get to write off a lot more stuff than when it's passive income.
That's a great point, Eric. So would you recommend that if you own more than one property, just to go over that point in a little better detail, would you recommend that properties be kept separate and apart from each other when setting up an ownership structure?
Not necessarily. They should be kept separate from a bookkeeping perspective, but they can be all held in a corporation. They could all be belong to the same corporation, but they should be kept separate from the life of the owner.
Right.
From the life of the owner and the family of the owner. You know, if you go to a developer in Ottawa, you find out they're all incorporated, even small developers. Right. And the reason that they're all incorporated is because they want to separate, you know, their life, you know, from that development that they're doing, from that real estate job that they have, from that real estate enterprise.
That would make sense. It also, I suppose, would make sense if you have multiple owners of a property, where the only real way, obviously, you can't bring somebody, or you don't want to bring somebody outside of your family or your holding company, that company which owns your real estate asset, into that company, or there is no real easy way to do that. So it's best if you own property with multiple individuals,
yes,
to incorporate that as a separate entity. Would you agree with that, Eric?
Yes. And that happens when four friends get together and one of them does not have the wherewithals to invest, but between the four of them, they can come up with the funds to buy a property.
Exactly.
That should never happen unless they're incorporated.
Yes, absolutely.
That should never happen unless they're incorporated.
Yeah. And we do that. We speak a great deal about co-ownership and co-tenancy projects. Yeah. And that is one of the first. It's right up there. That's the first thing you're going to want to do.
Yes. Like if you come to my office, you will find out that there is no sharp objects in my office, no ashtrays. And that's because we have to manage sometimes people who were very, very pro in union, you know, people who thought that the other three people were their best friends in the world, to the point where they want to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to kill their lawyers and their accountants that are in the same room. So I take all of the objects out of my office. And sometimes I leave the office and I let them stay here and scream and throw things at each other.
And that's why you need a really good co-tenancy agreement, people.
Yes.
A really good one. Bernie.
So speaking of oppositional forces, our friends in the CRA, Canada Revenue Agency, how do they deal with capital gains, or how should we manage our capital gains so that we are in compliance and feeling happy about it before we find ourselves in a problem?
The biggest problem in capital gains and real estate is the attitude that the property is depreciating over time that some people have. And we do that by saying, well, I'm going to claim capital cost allowance. And you cannot do that with land. You know, land is land and you cannot depreciate it, but the building you can depreciate. The problem is that real estate tends to appreciate over time. It tends to do the opposite as depreciate. So when we depreciate a building over time, let's say 10 years, and the building was put in the books for, let's say, $300,000. So now the $300,000 is $30,000. And now I come along to buy it, and you say to me, ah, that's now $250,000 and the land is $700,000. Well, that little trip that you did through depreciation is called recapture, because you said that it's going to depreciate, but now you're saying it appreciated. So when you said it's going to depreciate, you wrote off 4 or 5% a year of that bill. You wrote it off. After 10 years, you say, well, no, it came up in value. Now, all of those 4 or 5% per year now that you wrote off need to be repaid back to the government. And that is not a capital gains, that's a recapture, and that's a straight repayment. And that happens when you have only one property, because you cannot pool it in the capital cost allowance table. You cannot say, well, you know, one win, one loss. You know, you cannot do that. You isolated that one property, and then you have to repay that recapture capital gains or the capture depreciation. Then you have that, and then you have the appreciation of the land that you have to pay capital gains on. So, you know, if you don't plan properly, you can get hit with a 1-2 punch in the head that when you come up to the surface again, you might not know where you are. Now, that doesn't happen very often, because there's people like me in the world that make sure that you do not depreciate real estate. And it doesn't have to happen to people who buy real estate, you know, home-based businesses. A lot of people who run home-based businesses want to depreciate the home, want to have capital cost allowance on the home. That automatically segregates that home office from the personal residence, and now you have the recapture problem. So if you have an accountant, they will always tell you, do not depreciate the building. Depreciate the running of the building and not the building.
Great points. Seems very rudimentary to seasoned real estate investors, but that is something that the beginning or neophyte investor needs to know.
Yes.
Again, that's a very, very good reason for seeking out someone like Eric and getting your books in order. Are capital gains treated differently in the United States than they are here in Canada, Eric?
Not entirely so. What you have in the U.S., what I find, and in my humble opinion, because I'm not an American accountant, what I find is that residency determines a lot of the times how you're going to get taxed. Mm-hmm. And who determines residency for real estate is not your passport, and it's not the amount of time you're there. It's the state government.
True.
So in Florida, you can be there all year, but they could turn that you are not a resident because you are not a Floridian and you come from another country and you go back to the other country anyways.
Yeah.
And that means that when you hold real estate in Florida, there are taxes that Americans get or exemptions that they get that foreign investors do not get, including the capital gains exemptions are not as attractive for foreign investors as they are for Americans.
Yeah, I believe, Bernie, we actually had that as a question going way back last year that we answered. And it was very specific. Like a Canadian could sell their property up to a certain point, but if they sold it to another American who was moving into that unit, there was next to no capital gain. But if the Canadian was selling over and above a specified amount, the full force of capital gains tax came to bear.
Yes.
So it's a little more involved than, again, if you're going to invest in U.S. real estate with an eye towards eventually selling it, what you need to do is get the right type of advice, because it's not the same. So in some cases, it's better. In some cases, not so much better. And again, as Eric said before, it has a great deal to do with whether you're a U.S. citizen or not. Now, we're speaking about the U.S., but that would apply in just about any other country that you may own real estate. In the U.S., it's even more specific state-wise. I mean, it's from state to state to state. I think here in Canada, we've got a more uniform national type policy when dealing with it. So for the benefit of our listeners, could you explain the difference between a capital expenditure and an operating expense? I know you touched base on it a little earlier. I'm wondering whether we could make it a little clearer to some of our listeners.
A capital expenditure, by definition, regardless of what it is something that is going to give you value for more than 1 year. So if you buy a printer for your office and you're going to keep it for 3 years, you cannot say that the value of that printer was spent all this year, because it still has value after the first year. So when you have items like that, you have to separate them and say, that is going to be, you know, something that is going to bring me value for more than 1 year, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And real estate is always that. It gives you value by definition for 25 years or more. So that item is called, you know, a capital item. You cannot depreciate it. You cannot have it as a running expense. And if you do, if you have it as a running expense, it's only the portion that you used this year that you can use as a running expense. A capital expense, in numbers wise, it tends to increase your equity. When you buy stuff, you know, that you capitalize, it tends to increase equity. It tends to say, this is what I own. I own buildings, I own land, I own factories, I own all of that. And all of that become assets, you know, it's something that you own. And when you go to the bank, it's one of the things that is put in a ratio when it comes to debt to equity issues. That's the equity that the bank is talking about. That sometimes is called skin in the game. That's what you have in the game. Okay. So if you have a very thin business where you have cash and accounts receivable, and then you have a mortgage, you know, you have a very poor equity position with the bank, because all your equity is based on one asset only that can disappear quite fast. Cash can disappear, you know, as we all know, just walking down the street and stopping to buy a coffee, it can disappear. So cash disappears fast. Accounts receivable do not disappear as fast, you know, but if you don't have anything else, there's no equity for the lender to take. There's no position to take. They have no security to take.
So there's a real advantage to increasing the amount of capital investment, because it creates real equity rather than taking the short-term attitude that, well, I've spent so much on this particular printer, so I'm going to write the whole thing off, which does nothing but reduce, if you don't have proper accounting advice, it reduces your actual net at the end of the day, which just depreciates the value of your assets. So the proper thing to do is to take that expenditure and capitalize it.
Yes. It happens in real life with business more than real estate, because with business, you know, sometimes I will go to a client's company and I'll see, you know, a company with 15 employees, a lot of furniture, a lot of equipment, a lot of this and that. But if you look at their balance sheet, they own nothing. Everything was leased. So they own nothing and everything is being paid off and the balance sheet has nothing on it. So they're saying to you, you know, all of this stuff here is being used already. We are just, you know, using it now, but it's worth nothing. Mm-hmm. And what happens is when they get to sell that business, they're not going to sell it for nothing. Then they say, well, how can you sell this for nothing? I have 15 employees. I have all of this value here. Although the books say that you don't have any value. So we develop an account called Goodwill that invents all of that value that you should have had in your balance sheet, creates it, because that's the difference between what the seller is going to pay you and what your books say you're worth. It's against the benefit of the buyer to buy Goodwill. They can only write it off at 5% per year, right? So the tendency for the buyer is to come and say, I want to recapitalize this place. You have all kinds of equipment there. You know, when the buyer says that, and if you allow that, then you have recapture. So sometimes deals do not happen because the buyer wants to buy it with recapture, wants to recapitalize the business to what it actually is worth. And the seller says, no, I'm going to get clobbered in tax with that. I'm not selling. And they might recapitalize it over the next 5 years. They might put something over the next 5 years to change the value of the business, or they might want to sell their shares. And if you sell the shares of a small business, there is a lot of attractive tax benefits for that. And that's why sales are short most of the time, because there is no value in the property that is happening.
Right. And that adds further to the comment about incorporating your assets. I mean, because it also allows for an easy transition ownership. Yeah, for sure. That's a great point. Bernie.
What's the guideline for a property owner? What should they expect to pay for their financial statements and filing their corporate return?
If they're incorporated, the relationship is different. First of all, let's talk about the relationship of the accountant between a personal tax return and a company. A personal tax return, we have no responsibility whatsoever in the impact of that work. We have to check it that it's right. We have to check it that it's plausible, that it's realistic. But we do not say, are you running that place well? You know, could you run it better? You know, are you using all of the benefits that you should be using? We don't. You know, we are tax preparers. There is a difference between H&R Block and an accountant in that we're going to ask more questions. H&R Block has a tendency of don't ask, don't tell, right? We have a tendency of ask all the time. Right. So if I see someone in my office that is 44 years old, has a teenager, and is a single person with a teenager, I am going to ask, do you get support payments? Yeah. Where at H&R Block, I'm not allowed to ask. I just have a single person with a teenager. That's the difference. And sometimes, you know, it's for the benefit of the person. And sometimes it's for the benefit of the government in that I don't allow people to cheat the tax system, you know, but most of the time it's for the benefit of the person that we say those things and we do those things. So a personal tax return for someone who has real estate is usually under $1,000, depending on how much real estate they do and what other things they do in their lives. But it's usually, you know, at least in my office, it's usually been, you know, under $1,000. A corporation, a relationship is totally different because now, you know, we are told by our bodies that now we are responsible to society and the client, that now we have to be able to really, you know, understand the client, really, you know the client, really make sure that they're compliant with the rules of the country, make sure that they are doing things legitimately, that there's no fraud in the place, there's nothing of that going on. So no matter how little the business, if it's incorporated, I am asked to be more responsible for it than when I do a personal tax return. Mm. And that means that we're going to do more checking, more accounting, and that means that it's going to be more expensive. And an incorporation is usually over $2,000 when we do an incorporation.
Thank you for that explanation. That's really useful information. Tremendous. I have one more question for you.
Yes.
Are income and expenses for properties located elsewhere other than Canada reportable to CRA?
The short answer is yes. The more developed the country is, the faster reportable is going to be.
Really? Right?
So if you have properties in Portugal, which is part of the EU, in 2 years, CRA will find it. If you have properties in Kenya, you know, that farther away from CRA, it's going to take them 5 years to tell Canada.
So this is where, I suppose, the potential for double taxation comes into play.
Yes.
So is that a very real concern if you own property outside of the country, like if you own property in Portugal, anywhere in the EU, that
yes,
to be taxed by the country of origin or where the asset's located? And back home?
Yes. The problem is that if you have property in a higher taxed place than Canada, Canada will say, we won't give you credit for all of those taxes. We'll give you credit for some of those taxes. Because, you know, they may be envious of a property of a place that charges more tax than they do. Right.
Oh, really? So you won't get 100% credit?
You never get 100% credit. The other thing happens when you invest in a place like Malta, which is a much lower tax rate than Canada, then they will say, no, no, we should be taxing you for the whole amount because you're not in a place that is taxing you enough. So that's the argument that we have all the time. And that's why people go to tax court.
Wow. That sounds a little too arbitrary for my taste.
Well, CRA is a referee. People have to understand that CRA does not write laws. They're the referee. The Department of Justice writes laws, and the Department of Finance writes laws. They give CRA the Tax Act, and they say, administer it. And sometimes there is difference in opinions as to how they administer that. You know, is it in the spirit that the Department of Finance wrote the legislation, or are you just, you know, taking your own view on it and taxing people on your own view? And when that happens, you go to tax court.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like something I'd much rather avoid if at all possible.
Yes, yes. Although tax court has changed a lot over the years. Right now, if it's that problem that I just described and I send it to tax court and I take the fast track system that they have, someone will read it in tax court. And if they think it's a CRA problem of intransigence and that they are not listening to the taxpayer, they will tell CRA, open your file and listen to the taxpayer.
Oh, really?
And once the tax court tells that to CRA, they have to listen because they don't want to go back to tax court and me say, no, they're not listening.
Wow, that sounds really, yes, that's, you know, doesn't sound as medieval as I thought it would.
No, tax court is now around, you know, the Industrial Revolution age and not the medieval age.
Eric, this has been such an informative podcast, not just for me, but I'm sure for our listeners as well. I really want to thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
It was our pleasure. I'm sure our listeners are going to have all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for them to reach out to you? Keep in mind that your preferred contact information will be on the podcast notes, so someone can always reference that. What do you prefer, an email, phone call? Email
is probably better because it's more permanent and it's less forgettable than a phone call.
That is.
And other people read it and tell me to answer it.
You have one of those too.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much, Eric.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
So, Eric, as is the tradition here on the Property Wizard, we always ask our guest, when there is a guest, to explain to our listeners a particular word of the day. In this case, it's words. Could you possibly explain to our listeners, and this may seem a little rudimentary, but believe you me, I've seen several people get hooked on not quite understanding the difference. Could you explain the difference between an income statement versus a balance sheet?
An income statement and a balance sheet are part of the same document called financial statements. A balance sheet is I come into my house and take a picture of what I own, and I can sit and say, I own all of this. A profit and loss statement or an income statement is what I did in the house, what happened in the house that year. We put an addition, built a deck, we did all of that kind of stuff, and all of that had expenses. And some of those expenses that increase my house value, you know, were expendable through a profit and loss because it belonged to the year. So in a business situation, it would be what, you know, the company had sales from day one. You know, January 1st, they started selling. December 31st, they finished the sales cycle. And they had sales and they had expenses. They had payroll. They had all that kind of stuff, GST, all that kind of stuff, all of that to the end of December. That was what they did that year. At the end of December, there was money left over after all those expenses. Let's say $25,000 was left over after everything. That $25,000 gets out of the profit and loss into the balance sheet as a retained earning and increases the value of the business. And in January the 1st of the next year, they start at zero again. Zero, they start working, they start selling, they start spending. And at the end of 2023, they have, let's say, a $10 gain. So that gets back here to the balance sheet in retained earnings, and then they start again. So the balance sheet is the permanent statement of the business, is what shows, you know, who you are, and what you own. The income statement shows how you're getting there.
That's pretty clear to me. One of the greatest things about this, Eric, is that you've managed to make such a dry topic, a topic like accounting, you actually have a great sense of humor. You've made it really entertaining.
You know, because numbers are just a reflection of people. You know, that's what I teach my students. It's the reflection of somebody. It's not the somebody, it's the reflection. So you have to get to know the somebody to be able to understand the reflection.
Great insight. Tremendous insight. Thank you again, Eric. It's been our pleasure. Listeners, please join us next podcast when we'll be highlighting another investor profile. Join Bernie and I while we interview real estate investor Joe Nerotter as he shares with us his real estate investment journey. Thank you, and thank you for listening. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
All together now, that's great. Thank you, listeners.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.